Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. Now, you know that we're fans of travel. We're fans of adventure. Everyone should be. And today, we have a weird one that we we did this in advance. Finally, we decided in advance that this would be a two-part episode. So kudos to us for getting in front of that one. Hi, I'm Ben.
Hey, Ben, I'm Noel. Because it's about a place and the spirit of that place and the way that place figures into things like lore and culture and history. And, you know, we tend to bullet point things sometimes and try to compress large topics into short episodes, but we felt like an entire land deserved two episodes at the very least, if not a trilogy. But have we ever done a trilogy, Ben? Have we ever gone that far?
We've done recurring series, Noel. We've done Idiomatic for the People. I still love that title.
I love that title too. I guess that's technically a trilogy. It doesn't have to go back to back to back, but then it'll eventually break the trilogy format. What is it? Quadrology?
Quadrilogy, yeah.
Yes. Speaking of which, we all know who that is. That's super producer Casey Pegram.
Mm-hmm. Super producer Casey Pegram, who has also been pitching us nonstop on his own obscure trilogy. Oh, it's funny because we're on Zoom and
I said too much, Ben.
Okay. All right.
Is that the LaBouche saga?
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Okay. I'm sorry, guys. I keep getting caught up in semantics here. What's a saga versus a cycle? Anybody?
Cycle's like, what, five or seven or something?
See?
Does it matter?
Nobody knows.
How many, what's the ring cycle? That's like five, right?
The ring cycle, the opera by Wagner?
Yeah, Wagner, yeah.
Yeah, I guess it is five.
A saga doesn't have a numerical value assigned to it. It's just a very long, involved story. Like I would say, for many people here in Atlanta, Georgia, voting in the primaries became a saga.
Oh my God.
Yeah. That's a sadly relevant example. But we have, speaking of, Noel, I like where you're going with this, maybe, we have a story about multiple sagas today.
Thank you for giving me the benefit of the doubt that I was going anywhere with it and caveating it with a maybe, because you have to hedge yourself a little bit there.
And real quick, before we get too far along, I just want to clear this up. The Ring Cycle is four parts. It's four operas, not five, like I said before. So I don't want the hardcore Wagnerians out there to be yelling at me on their podcast player for the rest of this episode. So
yes, the Wagnerians, notoriously rabid fan base. So please accept our apologies. So this is a travel story. This is one of the perhaps most important travel stories in history. It's one of the big ones. It's about a place that I almost got close to going to in person. We're talking about the North Pole. There is right now, or there was pre-pandemic, a way for you to buy passage on a Russian icebreaker, which are fascinating, called the 50 Let Pobedy, which means 50 years of victory. And you can ride this ship up to the actual facts North Pole. Spoiler, I didn't go, but would you guys ever go to the North Pole if you had the chance?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I'm not really much of a snow guy, but it sounds like there's some beautiful, glaciers and stuff. I'm confusing the North Pole with Alaska. I shouldn't be doing that since we're doing an episode right now. Where are the Northern Lights? Those in the North Pole?
They're above the Arctic Circle.
Okay. Yeah. I'd go for the lights. Sure. How about you, Casey?
One of my favorite authors, William T. Volman, he is kind of a gonzo novelist. He likes to go to real places and do a lot of research before he writes about it. And so he was writing this like 7-part series all about North America. And on one of them, he went to the North Pole by himself and nearly froze to death. It was like way colder than he expected. He did not prepare well. And he was up there stranded for like, I don't know, 2 weeks or a month or something. And he nearly died, but he made it back and he wrote a cool book about it. So it all worked out in the end. But me personally, I don't know if I would go or not. I would probably go if I had all the gear I needed and whatever. Why not?
Yeah, I don't know. Jury's still out for me, I guess. But W.A. Forrester, who was an essayist and a lawyer from Toronto, wrote a piece in 1869 for the Toronto Globe that really put the North Pole in context in terms of its kind of mythological origins and the idea of the old Norse gods and Thor and his hammers and all of that. And he says in a quote from the piece, "For we are a northern people, as the true outcrop of human nature, more manly, more real than the weak marrow bones superstition of an effeminate South." So he's talking about how the North Pole is like the bastion of manliness and resilience and just general hardcore and badassery for the people of humanity. And largely it's because it truly is such an inhospitable place. An absolute frozen wasteland, completely disconnected from any semblance of society, like the writer you mentioned, Casey, found out to nearly his own demise. So it does have this kind of mythical place in everything from fiction to pop culture to, of course, things like map making and science, because it is the very definition of an extreme.
Mm-hmm. 100% agreed. And I think that's an interesting point here, Noel, because when you think about it, the North Pole is a place everybody knows about, but very few people ever visit for all the reasons we just mentioned. And it is and remains a very dangerous place. This is part of why there is such deep, rich mythology surrounding the North Pole. And what's interesting about W.A. Forrester here is that when he was talking about this, you know, the manly pole of the North Pole, he was continuing a process. He was joining in a long intergenerational narrative that mythicized the North Pole, and it went in step with European colonialism. So if we paint the picture of the Arctic the way that Forrester and his ilk portray it, it's terrible. It's far away from everything, like you said. It's harsh, it's bleak, and it's this sort of empty canvas for largely European people at this time to kind of write their own narrative about man versus nature, you know, any way they see fit. So there's something else that occurs here that I think will be familiar to anybody who's read about tourists in the Himalayas. There are indigenous people who live in this very harsh climate. They've been there for thousands and thousands of years. But in these stories, in these accounts by people like Forrester, they might as well be another iceberg or some piece, background set piece, or they're relegated to that terrible role of the noble savage stereotype. And this sounds like basic stuff we all know today, but at the time, this was what people believed. And the weird thing is, those images were not produced in the Arctic. They were the imaginations of all these other people who, oddly enough, to your point, Noel, pretty much lived in that effeminate South they railed against.
Totally. I mean, it's essentially colonization by imagination. I just coined that.
That's great.
I'm going to run with that. I like that. Colonization by imagination. You're taking ownership of a thing that you don't own or understand just by projecting your own kind of biases onto it. And that's the thing, though. The North Pole has had and continues to have an incredibly profound and kind of mythical place in cultures across the planet, this planet of ours, because of those reasons that we just mentioned, because of many of the special properties that it holds. Monarchs throughout history have funded voyages to the North Pole, partially looking for a sea route to connect the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, but also following these tales of these myths surrounding the North Pole and these like frozen, you know, tundra people and gods and, you know, fairies or whatnot, ice fairies. I don't know. I what do you think, Ben? Do you have any more details about like what kind of myths they were chasing?
Oh, yeah. There's this there's this very weird twist, of course, on the old Norse mythology, right? Like there's this idea that you are literally at the end of the world, and therefore you are walking from, you're crossing the boundary from the world of humanity into the world of legend. Like this is such an old idea, right? As early as 3000 BCE, people in multiple civilizations, Arabic civilization, Greek civilization, Egyptians, they thought that the entirety of the heavens, what we would call the cosmos today, revolved around the North Pole. And it was located under the star the Greeks called Polaris. And then, you know, we would also see real descriptions of actual things in that region that were depicted in increasingly fanciful ways over the long game of telephone that we call history, right? Like the Greek geographers.
Yeah, Pythias, who is an explorer and geographer from Greece, from ancient Greece, went there around 320 BC and talked about seeing these white bears on a sea of ice, which sounds like the stuff of legend, because those areas under Polaris, as far as they were concerned, were supposedly guarded by celestial bears, aka like imbued with some sort of power from on high, you know, or they had come from the other side, like through those gates, I guess, of the let's call it the afterworld, in honor of Prince's recent birthday. They were called Arctos. And that is actually where the name the Arctic came from. And these kind of myths really persevered throughout time and created a lot of the names that we know today, from these regions. So the, idea of, the ancient Norse Vikings seeing the northern lights as incarnations of their gods. And of course, we know about the idea of the Yeti or abominable snowman, which was always the scariest part of the Matterhorn to me. If you remember that ride at Disney, there was their part near the end where the abominable snowman kind of pops out and gives you a little fright. But this is also true in Nepalese culture. And the Greeks had their own conceptual version of an Arctic, and it was called Hyperborea, which would have been at the top of the world, you know, and that's where the name Borealis came from, the idea of the Aurora Borealis, which is the Northern Lights, of course, another name that they're referred to as. The funny thing is, though, a little different. The Greeks thought that the Arctic was some kind of tropical paradise.
Yeah.
Which is interesting to me, especially since all the Arctic lingo. What do you think about that, Ben? That's interesting.
I am over the moon, or should I say over the pole, over Polaris, to be able to finally start recommending comic books and graphic novels again. Fans of Hellboy and fans of BPRD already know what I'm about to say. If you haven't checked these out, Hyperborea figures heavily into the excellent writing of those series. But yeah, it's a real myth. And it's funny to me because there's this thing in Greco-Roman culture where they really like the idea of these elite communities, or kind of, I guess we would almost call them like the gated communities of the gods. This also probably calls to mind, It's not in the North Pole, I think it's in the South Pole, but it probably calls to mind for Marvel fans the idea of the Savage Land. It's this idea that there is a paradise, it is on Earth, it's just very, very difficult to get to. Over time, the myth of Hyperborea came to be associated with the lost civilizations tropes, like they, you know, were portrayed as incredibly advanced in scientific pursuits. But the weird thing is, these ancient cultures, even though they got some stuff wrong, to say the least, they were actually right about the North Pole being a tremendously unique and special place. In a book called North Pole, Nature and Culture, a scholar of the history of science and head of the Circumpolar History and Public Policy Research at the Scott Polar Research Institute at University of Cambridge. God, that's a long title. His name is Michael Bravo, and he has some great stuff to say about what makes the North Pole so unique.
Yeah, he wrote a book called North Pole, Nature and Culture, and he does a fantastic job of truly eliminating any questions about why the North Pole seems to continuously find such a special place in history and culture, and a lot of these connections and associations it has to other phenomena, and this is how he characterizes it. Quote, I offer the reader a way to understand why the North Pole truly matters to anyone who knows that our home, planet Earth, is a globe. The North Pole has refracted our understanding of the planet on which we live and the quest to master knowledge of who we are. And he goes on to say that when you're actually standing at the North Pole, technically every direction faces south. And the North Pole has the unique distinction that it continues to have to this day of having no allocated longitude or any time zone. And that's not lost on Bravo or anyone that has been, fascinated by this place. Emperors and philosophers, he says, throughout history have recognized how special this place is and all of that significance that actually defies time. But it all also is not somehow like immune to time. I don't know. It's a little poetic and kind of like a high-minded way of talking about it, but it's true. It's a very special place. And that absolute extreme nature of its location really does give it some interesting properties, Ben.
Yeah. Think about the way that the location, the North Pole, has defined so much of what we do, even today, when the big maritime ages were hitting, like in the 15th and 16th centuries, navigators and sailors needed to understand something about the North Pole because it defined our ability to navigate the globe. You know, like Bravo writes, without poles, there could be no geography. There could be no system of orientation for navigation. And so we as a species had to create new ways to understand the structure of the planet. And the North Pole became one of our main keys to answering this question, which it sounds silly to phrase it this way, but here's the question that baffled civilizations for millennia. It's this: what time is it right now? And where the hell are we? And where are we going? They seem like really basic questions now, but some of the smartest people in history were working around their version of the clock to figure this out. That's why you can see all this magnificent artwork that's functional artwork too, like globes and maps from this time period.
Yeah, I mean, because when we say poles, we're talking about the spots where the little C-shaped clamp connects to the globe when you mount it so that you can spin it around. Those are the axes that it spins on. And it truly does give us the ability to kind of look at our planet from the top down, which is a thing that was really unique at the time. During the Renaissance, for example, all sorts of thinkers and mathematicians and artists, map makers created all of these globes that we're talking about and all of these maps where the North Pole was the most important feature because it gave you a frame of reference for everything else that you were looking at. And a really great article on arctictoday.com talks about how this really allowed people this new kind of perspective and the ability to truly get an understanding of the kinds of voyages that were very, very well known, like those undertaken by Vasco da Gama and Christopher Columbus and other influential explorers.
Yeah. And now we're going to get into, just for a second, we have to acknowledge the international politics at play here because this powerful, powerful place, right? It's something that, of course, the leaders of the world want to control. As a matter of fact, in 1578, Queen Elizabeth assigned one of her, one of her court nerds, a scholar, in other words, to try and make a case that said Britain owns the North Pole. Spoiler, it didn't work out. But to underline how important this was to people and remains, maybe we can talk about some specific examples. So the first let me not put my conspiracy hat on here, but it's widely agreed that the first real map of the North Pole comes to us in the 16th century by a guy named Gerard Mercator. That name should be familiar to cartography fans. And the thing about this map is he tried his best. He's best known for the Mercator projection, but he did a really cartoonishly inaccurate job on this one, which is not his fault. He's working with what he had, and he's a very smart guy. The Mercator projection, of course, is trying to solve that old problem of how do you depict a three-dimensional sphere on a two-dimensional surface, aka a map, right? How do you take those curved lines, make them into straight ones? This projection, when he invented it, it was invented for sailors so that they could plot kind of a straight line A to B course. And when he came out, I believe it was specifically 1569, right? Nolan, when he came out with this this world map.
Yeah, and he swore by his math and his calculations and said that this particular world map, again, this isn't a globe, this is a two-dimensional map that you can use for charting courses, that this would be free of any of the miscalculations of previous maps. He referred to them as any of those errors which must necessarily be encountered on the ordinary charts of shipmasters, because his was nothing if not extraordinary. He had to figure out how to do this and maintain some semblance of scale or some semblance of kind of like continuity. And so he did have to sacrifice some accuracy in some places in order to make these trajectories work. In order to do that, he did have to stretch some of the parts of the map, which made for an interesting comparative experience when you're, say, looking at parts of the south versus parts of the north. Africa and Greenland, for example, on this map look almost identical, even though Africa is obviously about 14 times the size of Greenland. But, you know, it was a small price to pay for accurate navigation abilities.
Yeah, that's a good point and very well put. You know, you got to stick with what works. Here's the deal, though. Under the constraints of his own calculations, under the constraints of this, let's call it Mercator math, there was a problem with the North Pole. It would be so ginormously outsized that it would appear to be almost infinite. So Mercator cheated a little bit. Instead of putting it in this overall, this actual projection that he was making, he said, I'm going to put a small top-down view of the Arctic just in the bottom left corner of my world map. So this is the thing here. You can see it. This is why historians consider it to be the first true map of the Arctic. And, you know, Mercator and his followers, his protégés, his interns, they continually updated the map with the best information they had. But the story of maps alone is so compelling because they have such power in society. And, you know, like a lot of us, I don't want to date myself too bad here, but I grew up looking at the Mercator map and wondering, just in awe of how large Greenland appeared to be. Did you guys have those when you were in school?
Yeah, we looked at, I guess, a few different projections, but that was definitely one of the ones in the mix.
I think I did. I mean, they're just the ones that kind of have like the little gridded out kind of sections, some of them which are like stretched, right? Isn't that the idea? Yeah. I think that's okay. So yeah, definitely.
So why is this inaccurate? Here's the thing. It turned out that Mercator made a call that a lot of people have made in the past, because you see, there are two North Poles, right? There's the physical North Pole, right, which we have assigned, right, the quote-unquote topmost point, even though there's not really an up or down in space. And then there's the magnetic North Pole, a.k.a. the reason compasses work. And the magnetic North Pole is not in the same location as the physical North Pole. You know, Mercator is working off a very limited set of information. Like, by the 1500s, I don't think there's a hot take, turns out not a ton of people had ventured up to the Arctic, let alone the North Pole. They wouldn't get there for what, hundreds of years, right?
You know, but Mercator was a go-getter, and he wasn't going to let that stop him. But he obviously couldn't, you know, get firsthand knowledge, so he had to dig around and use what he had at his disposal, like we talked about before. He found something called Inventio Fortunata, which means fortunate discoveries. And that was a travel log written in the 14th century anonymously. And he referred to the writer as, quote, an English minor friar of Oxford who traveled to Norway and then pushed on further by magical arts. Magical arts. Okay, you got my attention. Let's go on. And one thing that he learned from this and gleaned from this book was what he ended up using as the centerpiece for his Arctic map, which was a giant rock exactly at the, I guess you could say, the terrestrial North Pole, the actual position where that would be. And that was called the Rupus Nigra El Altissima, or Black Very High Cliff. And this was something that people pretty much accepted at the time. And a lot of folks thought that it had some kind of magnetic properties, which was the reason that everyone's compass pointed north. But Mercator wasn't quite convinced of this magnetic part of the equation. He definitely thought that it was the physical centerpiece of the map, but he wasn't quite sure that that was where the magnetism was coming from. So he actually used a different location to describe the magnetic pole, which is in the top left corner of his map, north of the Strait of Anyan.
So as everybody knows, there is only one fan base more rabid than the Wagnerian fan base, and that's the Mercatorites. We know that we're telling you some stuff that might be hard to hear, but again, he's a very intelligent person working with the tools he had at the time. But there's more to his story. You're probably wondering, what the heck are polar pygmies? That's the phrase they used. What are all those rumors of a whirlpool about? Well, we're going to tell you in part two of our episode on the mythology of the North Pole. How was that for a segue, Noel? Does that get us out there?
Ben, are you big black cliff hanging us?
There we go.
Is that weird? No, that was the thing. Remember the? Okay, it was a Mercator joke. Yeah, okay.
I think we've got some time before part two to brainstorm, maybe get a whiteboard and work on some of our Mercator our Mercator stuff. It's been a crazy week.
A snow whiteboard?
There we go.
No? Yeah. Okay. Kill me. Just what? Put me out of my misery.
Yeah, I think we're in North Pole position to explore the rest of Mercator's story in part two. We hope that you have enjoyed this so far. If you have been to the North Pole, please, please, please let us know. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter, not just as a show, but as individuals.
That's right. You can find me on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown, or I post lots of pictures of my daughter doing anime cosplays, in addition to a lot of cooking, and also now that I'm in my new studio, probably some music creation stuff.
You can find me fighting the good fight for some cause or another at BenBolinHSW on Twitter. You can also see my various misadventures around here and around the globe at BenBolin on Instagram. Spoiler alert, guys, I think I might actually be traveling out of the country in August. I'm not sure yet, so no promises, but I might get there.
Godspeed, Ben. Couldn't do it without Mercator.
He's the real hero here.
You know what, Ben? You're the real hero here. And we don't need another hero.
I need a hero, just like the song. And and speaking of heroes, thanks, of course, to our incredibly patient super producer, Casey Pegram.
Yes. Thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme, Christopher Hasiotis, here in spirit. Jonathan Strickland and his devious doppelganger, the Quister, who, I, if I'm not mistaken, is definitely due for a diabolical drop-in. I can't think of another D thing, but I got there. I did my best.
I think you did well. We've got the time Arctic talking away here, and it's only a matter of time before he shows his face again. Like any good villain, he's always just around the corner. So I guess we need to go ahead and sew this up. I don't know about you guys, but I actually got chills while we were talking about this. I think I'm in the zone.
The Arctic zone. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.